Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation features Claire G. Coleman. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture. My name's Andrew Popel. Every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft is dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to household names. Every week we look into the issues that drive our storytelling to help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands, pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, that these are unceded lands, and that treaty has never been made with the First Nations of this country. Now, Claire G. Coleman is a Noongar writer from Western Australia. She is a great favourite and guest on this show. We've been fortunate to have her earlier in the year. Her debut novel was the award-winning Terra Nullius. She's the author of the novel The Old Lie. And Lies Damn Lies, which Claire joined us for earlier in the year, is an historical cultural exploration of the ongoing impact of colonial invasion. Today, Claire's joining us with her third novel. It's called Enclave. Enclave takes us to the community of Safetown. There, residents live a comfortable life, secure in the knowledge they're protected by the wall. Within that concrete edifice, security patrol their streets and drones surveil the airways to ensure even the smallest transgression is met with swift consequences. Christine has spent her entire life basking in the comfort that her father's wealth and that Safetown's security provide the daughter of an influential family. Sure, her father is a distant figure, her mother a high-functioning alcoholic, but they've just bought her an apartment, they've extended her a line of seeming unlimited credit. Christine has space and agency within the confines of Safetown. And Safetown was built to protect families like Christine's, and she should be happy with this safety. Except her best friend Jack is missing, and Christine has begun to notice differences. Differences between her and her servants. Differences between people who don't quite look like her. Join me as we discover Claire G. Coleman's Enclave. Hello.
Hello.
How are you, Claire?
Not bad. Not bad at all. How are you?
I am really good. This looks like a little bit more relaxed for you. Or was it? It was about 3 or 4 months ago we were chatting and you were on the side of the highway somewhere?
Yes, I was. I was in South Australia. Funny thing about that is, because we're talking about Lies Down Lies, I was talking about politics. And at the end of the interview, some old guy who'd been standing, milling around, looking, reading info signs, turned around and said, "That's really interesting," and walked off. So he was actually only pretending to mill around, reading info signs, actually listening to our conversation.
That's awesome. That's really cool. You're just like, tune into the Final Draft podcast for more. That's incredible. I mean, I guess you don't want people eavesdropping on all your conversations, but I'm so glad that he got to discover a little bit about the book.
Yeah. I think Lily gave him a business card, with my book cover on it.
Oh, incredible. That's awesome. And now we have Enclave.
Yes. Thank you for the review. I read it yesterday, I think.
Can I also compliment, I'm sure this is probably not something you have a lot to do with, one, on the cover of Enclave, but two, the fact that your arc kind of looks like a book. So when I get sent an arc, I still want to keep it. This is going on my bookshelf. And it looks beautiful. Like, it doesn't look like a pre-release.
I insist on kind of cover veto and on discussing the cover. We went through about 30 or 40 or something revisions of the cover before I said it was good enough. So yeah, it has something to do with the cover. But whether or not you get a really good looking arc basically depends on how many books Hachette think you're going to sell.
Right.
So the bigger name you are, the prettier your arc. Like the arc for Terra Nullius was basically monochrome. Right?
Yep.
The arc for The Old Lie was three color cover. Like they use a three color chip, a three color matte printing method. And this one looks exactly the same as the old book, but without the new book has some high gloss. Nice. The UV reactive high gloss spots on it. Nice. Spot gloss, but
oh well, look, I mean,
it's exactly the same.
I like it. This is just a weird note to start the conversation on, but I like it. I appreciate that I've got an arc that I feel happy to put on my bookshelf for friends to discover or for when I want to go back and read. It is a very unique novel. I can't wait to get into it. We should get into it. But
let's get into it.
Claire G. Coleman is a Noongar writer from Western Australia. She's now based in Naarm. Claire's debut novel, the award-winning Terra Nullius. She's the author of the novel The Old Lie and Lies, Damned Lies, an historical and cultural exploration of the ongoing impact of colonial invasion. And I reckon it's a pretty good year when I get to have two chats with Claire, and that's what's about to happen because Claire's third novel, Enclave, is out in the world. Welcome back, Claire. It is terrific to have you on.
It's really good to be on the show again. I actually really enjoy talking to you.
Call us anytime. You don't have to write a book, but we're always happy when you do. I want to.
Okay, I will. Like if I want to give an opinion on something, I'll give you a call.
Oh yeah, I can sell that, Claire's. Claire, we have to come up with a title for this, but yeah, like Claire's gonna give us her two cents. All right, let's take people to Safetown. Enclave takes us to the community of Safetown. There, residents live a comfortable life, secure in the knowledge they are protected by the wall. Within that concrete edifice, security patrols their streets and drones surveil the airways to ensure even the smallest transgression is met with swift consequences. Christina spent her entire life basking in the comfort. The comfort that her father's wealth and Safetown security provide the daughter of an influential family. Sure, her father is a distant figure, her mother a high-functioning alcoholic, but they've just bought her an apartment and extended her a line of seemingly unlimited credit. Safetown was built to protect families like Christine's, and she should be happy with this safety. Except her best friend Jack is missing, and Christine has begun to notice that things are different. Her servants are people who don't quite look like her, and she is not quite like everyone else. Claire, how do you feel about that introduction? I feel like I've covered the beginning of the book, and I don't want to go too much into the rest of it. Is that how you introduce Safetown?
It's probably better than how I would introduce Safetown. So you've done quite well. It's really hard to introduce one's own book often, but you've managed to introduce the conflict and the story and what it's all about and the world and the protagonist without giving away any significant spoilers, which for reviewing me is actually not, I'm not the easiest author to review, I'll be perfectly honest.
I want to come to that fact in a minute. First, I want to acknowledge that Enclave seems to be stamped with the worst of our recent history. There's a wall separating people. There's devastated Pacific islands rebuilt as artificial communities. There's near sentient algorithms tracking the population. Can you talk me a little bit through your world building? I mean, is this, are you literally just taking the news to the nth degree? Was this stuff keeping you up at night?
It's a bit of all that. Part of the intent was to take the world we are choosing to live in and extend it into the future and see what would happen if we don't change our path. And that's kind of what the plan. And, of course, and some of the stuff was done with that intent, to show the worst of human nature extended to the greatest extent I can think of. Some of it was stuff that was genuinely keeping me up late at night, and some of it was probably stuff that I dropped in without really thought about it. That thing which all authors do and often don't admit to doing, which is things we're thinking about but not very coherently slip into our books, and that becomes our first coherent thought about something that's annoying. So some of those things they were in my subconscious but not in my conscious mind until I wrote them and I went, oh yeah, that is actually kind of something that makes sense for our future. And part of paranoia came from, it's not very well known, but I have an honours degree in AI theory. It's not very well known, it's not like a secret, but everyone's so shocked, I think they forget, but I have an honours degree in computer science, specialising in artificial intelligence. And I could see, back when I did that degree, I finished in 2006, I could see the extent to which things like the algorithms used by Facebook and Instagram and Twitter to spy on our everyday lives were possible. And that's kind of, and it made me paranoid about artificial intelligence back then. And now, like 16 years later, we're allowing countries to surveil us, not countries, companies to surveil us, not even governments, we're allowing the companies we buy products from to keep an eye on us and market things to us, when really we should be thinking about how much should Google, Facebook, et cetera, know about our lives.
I mean, realistically, it'd probably be safer if countries were doing it, not companies. Companies are very savvy about this. Looking at the administration we just got rid of, they probably would have messed it up if we left it to them. But it is this incredible, scary technology. I'd like to also acknowledge you sort of talked about how getting it on the page was your first sort of way of coherently dealing with the things in your mind. Like, that's you, and that's wonderful. You know, the rest of the world, the first time we coherently say something that's been on our mind is usually drunk on Saturday night, and we immediately regret it. Like, you're onto something there. We should be writing this stuff down.
And that's right. And of course, I have a partially enviable position in that saying things that everyone's scared to say is kind of my job. So, and people respect me more if I say the things that they're thinking and are scared to say. It kind of increases the amount of respectability I get. Whereas people who work a 9-to-5 in a office or something, if they say the things that I say, they might risk being ostracized at work. But if I say them, because I'm a writer, because I'm a writer known for digging into the stuff that people are willing to say, I can't be harmed for doing it.
We're on a tangent here, but I want to continue with it because I know, because I follow you on social media, that your choice and your sort of your fearless ability to say the things that need to be said, it's not without cost, and that you do get targeted by trolls. In your novels, this is an incredible thing that you do because you are crafting a narrative that, you know, people can think about. But how do you feel broadly? Do you ever kind of just think, oh my goodness, or is that when the trolls win, when you kind of start to edit yourself?
Sometimes I feel like the social media stuff is a bit of a risk and kind of a personal risk. But I don't think I genuinely don't think I can receive any actual harm from this. And it's a case of all I cop is a bit of emotional abuse from trolls, which has a limited ability to cause actual harm. Of course, people get harmed by bullying from trolls, but I haven't been, so I'm okay. It's more case, I don't think I'll ever stop, because if I stop, it'll let them win. The social media trolls, what they're really about is removing the voices of everyone who's not like them. And if we remove ourselves, then they've won.
I see what you did there. This is a very clever segue back to Enclave, where we very much have to confront the idea of how voices are being silenced, how they're being removed. And to do that, we're going to have to look at Christine. And, like, in the nicest possible way, you've drawn a fairly unlikable character here. I found her really hard to like initially. But of course, it is going to be that journey that enthralls us, where we go with this character. But her attitudes, though, just can be really tough to read. I wondered how you felt about Christine and what it was like writing her. Like, what was your hook into Christine as your lead?
Thinking about Christine, we all know somebody. I know several people who have started out with quite deplorable personal attitudes about other people and about life, and who have matured into people who are a bit more, for want of a better word, a bit more woke and a bit more socially responsible. Everyone knows people like that, or so to an extent. We know people who are a little bit like that or a lot like that. And I want to write that character, the character who's who goes from being someone you would not want to like to, and then becomes over time someone who you would be rooting for. And that's kind of it's in a way an extension of my absolute love of likable villains,
okay.
which is a constant thing in my head. But the idea that a protagonist does what we all do, which is we mature. And I want to show a different sort of coming of age story where coming of age is someone coming into social responsibility.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that arc that Christine goes through. But something about the relatability that I also wanted to note here, because Safetown, it did not seem to me like a huge leap from many of the kind of exclusive or more high-income areas that you'll find in most of our capital cities. Do you think, and slightly tongue-in-cheek here, but do you think Enclave could have been a different story if Christine turned out to be a Teal independent?
The funny thing about that is it's one of those things where I wrote Enclave during the work. It was written quite a while ago. I can't remember exactly when I started writing it, but it was because of it got delayed. The release got delayed, so it was probably written more than finished about 2 years ago, I think, because it's been delayed so much. It was supposed to be September last year release originally, so that means, and that's normally 14, 16 months from when it's written, so it must have been delivered like 2 years ago or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing that is 2 years ago at the kind of the depth of our hopelessness in trying to overthrow the environmentally destructive and socially irresponsible far right in Australia. And of course, if I wrote it now, I don't think I would write the same book now. And I'm hoping that it hasn't lost its relevance now that we've kicked out that government. But it is almost like Christine's development is almost like somebody going from being a Liberal voter to a Teal voter. And it's exactly, and that's kind of what our society is doing. So Christine has moved with our society, is moving with our society at the moment.
You're making high economic areas seem way more sympathetic than they probably are. How do we progress here? I need to acknowledge that Christine's story starts to progress within her, you know, pristine community. She starts to notice there's a sameness. She notices her mother's heavy drinking, her highly surgically enhanced friends, the fact that everything's perfect, but that, you know, it's only perfect for certain people. And Christine is beginning to realize she is not one of those people. And I want to fly really close to the sun here in terms of noting that this may not go the way people think it's going to go.
One of my fans, they probably expect that anyway.
Well, though, yeah, no, I know as one of your fans how people are thinking. I felt like Enclave it gave us a few signals about its direction. So outcasts in a society, or in seemingly perfect societies, they often sort of become freedom fighters, you know, there's an underground band or something like that. You've entered a broadly dystopian space here. And I am only saying things that kind of, you know, I want to muddy the waters of expectation.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you feel about just the genre dystopian fiction? Were you entering that space consciously, and did you want to do something with it?
Yeah, it was conscious. I was, when I had first had the idea for Enclave, I was wanting to lean into a near future dystopia and see what I could do with that genre, because I'm a fan of that genre.
Mm.
I love reading it, and so yeah, it was very consciously a dystopia.
Mm.
And of course, what we forget about dystopias is historically every dystopia and we've had in the world has been a utopia for someone.
Mm.
And every utopia in the world has been a dystopia for somebody else. There's the classic example of when Australia was founded as a colony, it was like the promised land for a lot of working class British people or middle class British people came here and became very wealthy. In the meantime, Aboriginal people were being murdered and raped and oppressed. If you think about the Athenian democracy, it was considered to be a cultural and socio-political utopia, but only landed men could vote, and they had slaves. So what we consider to be a utopia, someone might consider to be a dystopia, and what somebody we consider dystopia, somebody wants it that way or it wouldn't be that way. Mm. And we kind of forget that about dystopians.
Even, even old Tom Moore, he appreciated his society needed to exist and it was a fundamental tenet of his society that they were in conflict with other societies. And a part of the functioning was that sort of to and fro conflict with the other societies because they weren't his utopia.
And don't forget I like reminding people of this. When Thomas More wrote Utopia, the word was translated into English, the word Utopia became a word in English, people were pronouncing it with the Greek letter for that's rewrite as EU, which means a better, something better. Whereas Thomas More intended the OU pronunciation version of U, which is how he wrote it in Greek, which is so in Greek, the word utopia, as Thomas More used it, means a place that doesn't exist or can't exist. So even Thomas More accepted that utopias are impossible.
Mm. Right now, I don't know about you. I have this thing where certain things just put songs in my head. So now I'm just going to have to play Augie March's "There Is No Such Place" under this section of the conversation. Sure. Why not? Dystopias often have a fraught relationship with characters from marginalized communities. I feel like sort of when we see a dystopia, there's usually sort of the hero who is emerging from the imperfect perfect utopia, and it can often reinforce othering stereotypes, the people who live outside. Mm-hmm. I felt like Enclave you were doing something very different. Yes, Safe Town is staffed by a class of workers who are exclusively non-white, but there is more to them, and we don't spoilers, we don't learn about it at the beginning of the book necessarily. What did you want to explore here?
So what you're saying?
That's okay. I was just thinking about the way you created that division, and again, without spoilers, because this does go into the progression of the narrative, but I was wondering what you wanted to explore here around agency and that juxtaposition between oppressors and the oppressed.
Well, yeah, the oppressors always are trying to remove the agency from the people they're oppressing. That's fundamental to most forms of oppression. If you think about, for example, in Australia's history, Aboriginal people had our rights to decide our own lives removed for generations. And people were locked up. People are locked up. That's a form of oppression. That's, again, removing people's agency to make their decisions. But I think a common mistake that is made by oppressive cultures is forgetting that the people they're removing agency from are capable of agency. Mm. There's this in a racist or some other sort of prejudiced society, they tend to ignore or forget about the agency of the people they're oppressing. They forget that people might find a way to resist or fight back. I think a lot of time oppressive cultures think the people who are being oppressed don't even want to resist or fight back. They might believe that people want to be are quite happy in the position they're in. And I think it's interesting to consider that what would happen. What are ways that oppressed cultures can express agency in a kind of form of resistance? There's the classic some forms of resistance in history, for example, have been workers or slaves simply refusing to work. Mm. The Gurindji walkout in Wave Hill in the Northern Territory, their resistance was they refused to work for 8 years. It was an 8-year-long strike. Now, that is a fairly strong form of resistance. The only agency they had was to not work, and that's the agency they took.
I'm also really interested. One way that oppressive regimes, invaders, colonizers will work to oppress is to try to remove like identity, and that may be through suppression and elimination of language, suppression of cultural practice, suppression of, I guess, any way of expressing identity. What you show us in Safetown, though, is it's almost they've taken, I don't know how to describe it, a prophylactic approach to that, where all the buildings are kind of the same, but with minor variations. Mm. All the women have had surgery to look almost the same. All the men are indistinguishable in their sort of grey business suits. Was that how were you forming that? Was that a sense of preemptive kind of like social flattening?
Well, in the novel, that's certainly what it was. But if you think about, it's kind of an extreme version of what would what happens if you are trying to homogenize society. You get enough homogeneity and things begin to look very same. Of course, if you're in a society that doesn't like difference, difference ceases to exist. Mm. And that's kind of what we lean to. That it's kind of similar to early communist regimes where everyone was in uniform. Mm. They kind of tried to homogenize society, like to squish out all the difference in culture. And that's kind of safe to ask, whereas what you would get if people do that to themselves.
Mm. All right. I can only talk about Safetown for so long without acknowledging that there's a lot more to this book. First place we're going to go, your fans, Claire, your fans know that you like a twist in your narratives.
Yes.
In lieu of spoilers, though, can you tell me about how you go about structuring narrative? Like, are twists planned or do they emerge in the process?
Generally, part of my process, and I can say this with confidence, so I don't think anyone would use this to steal my process, but I don't think it's that complicated or thought out idea anyway. I generally have very little of the story in planned out. I don't actually plan as such. But what I do have I have twists built into the narrative from the beginning before I start writing. Mm-hmm. I know what the twists are going to be. I don't necessarily know at which point of the book I'm going to deliver them, but I have a broad narrative arc in my mind. I never write it down, but it's in my mind at all times when I'm writing. And any twists that I put in are built into that from the beginning. They are always there. Otherwise, you can't really make them work. You have to know, in a way, you have to almost plot it backwards, mm-hmm. if that makes sense, or outwards from the, if there's a major twist. To use the example of Terra Nullius, which will help people who could probably most of your listeners would have read Terra Nullius. I wrote the twist first from Terra Nullius and then expanded the narrative out from there. So I wrote forward from it and backwards from it, plotted forward and backwards from it to make it make sense. Mm. It's kind of what you have to do. You have to have the twist in mind all times. And, of course, my second novel, The Old Lie, had so many twists that people probably didn't get stabilized. And that was also the intent. I knew was what the plot twists were and where I had to put them to make them work. I just kind of built the story around that. So yeah, the story is always built around the twists.
Yeah, and I think that was what unsettled me so much. Like, I know you like a twist. It wasn't, I don't know if I was expecting a twist, but it was like it was never out of the question. But in working into a dystopian space, I think you flagged for me, like people feel like, I know how a narrative's gonna run, and then you said no, actually, my dystopia doesn't work like that. So the twist happened, and I was like, "Yeah, of course, there's going to be what? That's what's happening." It was real. It's really interesting to work in a space, but also outside of it, or at least it was for me reading Enclave.
Well, there's, and I don't want to give it away, but there's several ways to do a twist, and I suppose in a way, a fun thing to do is to let people expect the twist and then not give them the twist they're going to expect. Mm. Or yep. let people – and I don't like my audiences being firm in their assumptions and getting what they assume they're going to get. I don't like that. That's no fun for me. Mm. And I, to be honest, my regular readers, and I do have people. There are people out there who love my books and my short stories and almost everything I write, and they actually like not knowing, like not being able to assume their assumptions are going to happen and pan out the way they want. People want, when they read my books, people want to be a bit more. They want the shock that happens to be not what the shock they expected. Mm. So I don't want to be M. Night Shyamalan, who I liked his early movies and his later ones not so much, because his twists became way too predictable.
Mm.
And I think that's what kind of why his later movies were not as enjoyable as his earlier ones. So I don't want to fall into that trap of people think I've got a formulaic way to throw in a wild bend in the middle of a narrative. I don't want that to be formulaic at all.
Mm. I had M. Night Shyamalan in mind at certain points in your book, and I'm glad I didn't drop that in, because I don't know where in his canon any reference I made would have fallen. It might have been a movie, one of his that you didn't like. I need to just acknowledge that Enclave goes a lot further than we're going to be able to talk about. Once again, you've left me saying wanting to say something like, we should come back and have this conversation again in a year's time when more people have read it. But I started with this idea that you had pulled elements out of our daily news feeds and, you know, exaggerated grew them to the nth degree. You don't just do that within the community of Safetown. A lot of where we go in, particularly the third sort of section of the book, also, I guess, takes things from today and accelerates them in a really interesting way. So without asking for spoilers, without asking you for to give anything away, Claire, if you could pick anything in the news right now and take it to its logical conclusion, good or bad, what would you do? This is we're kind of just, you know, spitballing here. What would you like to see happen better than it's currently happening?
Well, I when I look at the news cycle, of course, in Australia, the dominant news cycle thing is the teal wave, or the teal bath, as they call it during the election. That's probably the thing that has dominated our news cycle, and I think it's going to dominate the way politics is done in Australia for a long time. Mm. And what's interesting about the teal wave is it's shown Australia going abruptly a different direction to the countries who we normally follow lockstep in politically. Australia's gone a radically different direction to USA and the UK in the teal wave, in that the USA is going more economically conservative to an extent, though Joe Biden has changed that a bit. Australia is still economically conservative. The teals are economically conservative. We can't debate that. But they are extremely socially liberal as a rule, which is interesting, because there's been a comment before that people have been making for about 10 years that the Liberal and National parties and Liberal Nationals and the four parties that form the coalition, technically, have shifted far to the right on social issues, and have people were still voting for them because people were economically conservative in Australia and don't want to take radical risks with our economy. Mm. And that's fine. I mean, people can believe what they want, but what's happening was the Liberal Party's social policies were far out to the right of the Australian public. And what the teal wave is them being punished on that. And what I would like to see extend from the teal wave is Australia's politics become increasingly as socially liberal as Australia is as a people. Because the politics have been far to the right of our politics have been so far to the right from how Australians feel of people that it's easy to misunderstand how far to the socially to the left on social issues Australia is. So the classic example is the severe punishment of Catherine Deves for her transphobia in of Warringah. That was a demonstration. She actually got the worst swing against her in anywhere in her state, and that just shows that that's because she was a social conservative, even worse than the rest of the party. And I think we've learned less from that. And the Labor Party in their acceptance speech of winning the election, Albanese gave basically his for the first three or four points of his speech were basically teal talking points. So I think Australia has moved, well, it hasn't moved to the left. Someone once said to me, Australia hasn't moved to the left socially. We've always been socially to the left. But politically, we've moved towards social liberalism. And economically still kind of middle ground, but to our political discourse has moved far to the left on social issues. And I'd like to see that go further. I'd like to see us extend that to the point where the sort of social conservatism that's growing the rest of the world doesn't grow here.
Almost like a socially progressive mindset could lead to, you know, sort of larger responsibilities like good stewardship and even economic benefits. I'm like giving Claire a big wink here about so many things. I'm gonna end the interview and then say things like after the end of the interview that would be counted as spoilers. I am speaking with Claire G. Coleman, and we are doing that thing where we dance around the incredible twists and turns of her latest novel, which is called Enclave. Claire, thank you so much as always for joining me here on Final Draft.
Genuinely, thanks for having me. It was fun.
That's it for this great conversation with Claire G. Coleman. Claire's new book is Enclave. It is out now from Hachette. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Stay in touch. We are on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It is a great way to find out what's coming up, what you've missed out on, and all the links you need to find the great conversations about the books you love. Look, today I spoke with Claire G. Coleman. If you're a fan of Claire's work, you know that she has twists and turns. You know that there is stuff we couldn't spoil. That doesn't mean I didn't ask Claire about it. So if you've listened this far, you might be interested to know there is a spoiler episode where I ask Claire a few questions about Enclave that I couldn't feature in this conversation. If you've read the book, if you want to find out a little bit more about the narrative, tune in for our special spoiler episode of Enclave. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from incredible Australian authors on Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.